and welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns, and we welcome you guys back to this breakdown edition of the Battle for Floyd. Another Big Ten loss for Minnesota as their defense crumbles yet again in Big Ten play. Minnesota loses 48-31. And joining me, and Luke, as always, to break down these games, is gracious enough, was my second cousin and former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, Derek Burns. Derek, how are things in your world today?
Doing well, guys. Thanks for having me back and looking forward to another breakdown.
All right. We want to, again, thank our sponsor, the Goal Line Club. If you have not, I highly suggest checking out one of the tailgates. I did that this weekend. Pro tip there for those looking for a tailgate for future games. The weather has turned. A good portion of this tailgate is actually indoors inside of the front of Williams Arena. It is a very nice feature that you would be paying to join in on. I highly recommend it. If you are interested, check out goalineclub.org. All right, so let's get into this breakdown real quick. Again, 48-31 was the final. Iowa defeating the Gophers, retaining Floyd yet again. I guess the thing that stuck out to me immediately was the early quick start by Iowa getting up 14-0. You know, the Gophers haven't been super quick to start this season. They haven't been terrible, but especially in Big Ten play, they've been playing from behind in deficits. I mean, you can attribute this both to offense and defense, but maybe we'll start, Derek, with you. You know, what are the struggles that the Gophers are having, especially in early parts of the game so far?
Well, yeah, it was an interesting, to get in the hole like that, it presents an interesting problem for them, specifically against a team like Iowa. I guess the Gophers probably expected them to try and run the ball and control the clock, which didn't end up being the case. But regardless, in conference play, it's tough to get down early. You know, the Gophers, I think, had game plans to stop Iowa's run, you know, go plus one in the box. You can tell they had repped it a lot in practice. Don't think Iowa gave them anything in the running game that they hadn't seen. So they were prepared for that. But in the passing game, Iowa came out and was hitting on all cylinders early, which put them down quickly. And so, you know, that presents a problem for a team with a young offense to come back, come out of the hole. You have to be a little bit riskier with decisions, and then again, playing uphill against a physical team. So that's something that you know, definitely factors into the game script for them. And I think if anything, the Gophers offense had to, you know, go and challenge Iowa's defense in the passing game earlier. I do think that was part of their game plan going in, is to have the Gophers wide receiver core challenge the Iowa secondary. But I think that, you know, being down early just solidified that, and they ended up going to it earlier than maybe planned.
It hurts so much, especially for this young offense, that for the second straight week in the first quarter, they're down double digits already, where whatever the game plan was, which is probably something more of a balanced attack, has to be immediately thrown out the window, because you can't try to establish the run and drain clock when you're down 14 points in the first quarter. If you're very confident in your running offense and in your backs and the fact that your defense can get a stop. But in the current state of this Gopher defense, where Maryland runs for 300 against them 1 week, and then the next week Nathan Stanley throws for over 304 scores, you can't have a lot of trust in your defense to do really anything right. And so you have to get into pass happy mode. PJ Fleck talked about in the press conference afterwards how all these down the field throws that Minnesota was trying to force wasn't just because Anix had decided to, it's because Fleck told him to. Fleck literally told him, I want you to try and jumpstart this game and this deficit. And I'm not entirely sure that I agree with, yeah, we're down 10, 14 points here in the second half from playing catch up, but we don't need to force these 50-50 balls down the field, especially when Iowa's defensive backs, even though they were starting two true freshmen at cornerback, were starting to get confident and starting to make some plays. I'm still kind of lost in terms of what Rob Smith's trying to do on defense right now. Second straight year that this defense plays well in the non-conference and they come Big Ten play. Here we are talking about what is the identity of this defense. Now, to Derek's point, Minnesota schematically looked like they really wanted to shut down the defense. The running offense that Iowa possessed, they did it last year. The issue was Noah Fant and TJ Hockenson, the two Iowa tight ends, they were just a mismatch for Minnesota all day. 9 touches for them, 3 touchdowns, damn near 4 as TJ Hockenson gets hit out at the 1-yard line and a beautiful design by Iowa's offensive coordinator there. But it's the second straight week that Minnesota's defense, in my opinion, wasn't outmatched physically. They were just out-schemed. And they were out. It was all these mental mistakes that you were seeing that was en route to 48 points at home to Iowa. And that's very concerning to me, Luke.
Yeah, I think if you walk away from this game, before we focus on offense or defense specifically, I guess from my perspective, I walk away and I go, okay, so this offense is young, but holy cats, there's some serious talent, Rashad Bateman being one, right? Additionally, I think Anikstead still is showing promise. He maybe hasn't put together the like jaw-dropping numbers in terms of completion percentage, but you know he threw 3 touchdowns. And then defensively, you look and you go, okay, this is not a defense that is super young. It's actually fairly experienced, but you have some serious mental breakdowns or something of the sort. I think that you said this earlier, Ryan, they're not getting outmatched physically on offense, at least. It didn't seem that in the Maryland game.
Well, they are at right tackle.
No, I'm talking defense. Sorry, on defense.
Defensively, yeah.
On defense, it doesn't look like they're getting outmatched. I would agree offensively they are, but defensively they're not, and it's really hard. Maybe we'll focus on defense to start since you kind of segued there, but defensively, it's a little bit head-scratching at this point because, I mean, again, can't get pressure on the quarterback. That might be a player personnel issue. But right now, I mean, whether it's the running game getting killed against Maryland or just getting destroyed by Nathan Stanley and those tight ends, you know, there's something going on there that is not just player personnel.
It isn't. And you look at third down specifically, I know there was so much talk on the Twitter machine and on Gopher Illustrated that, yeah, I think it's still a little bit too soon to give up on Rob Smith as of we stand here today. But you look at the simple things that can be fixed. First drive of the game on 4th and 2, Minnesota's cornerback to the home side of the field is playing 10 yards off the line of scrimmage. I'm gonna ask Rob Smith that question on Wednesday, and he's not going to like it. I have no idea what you're trying to accomplish there by literally giving them the first down. That's Nathan Stanley is an experienced quarterback for Iowa at this stage of the game. He looks to that side of the field, sees Minnesota's playing 10 yards off. They run a quick out. It's a first down and 4th and 2. You play so well for the first 3 downs, and then schematically you have your cornerback play 10 yards off, who, by the way, is not a true freshman on that side of the field. It's Minnesota's transfer from the University of Florida and Chris Williamson. It's these little things that are just head-scratching. And on third down specifically, like I alluded to, Minnesota's defense gave up 10 third down conversions for 196 yards to the air. That's damn near 20 yards per completion. You can't do that and expect to win ball games. It's so hot and cold with this defense. You play so well to get to third and long, but then schematically and execution-wise, these guys aren't making the plays. Now, Derek, we can talk about pass rush because this pass rush is anemic at best. They have Carter Coughlin, and that is literally it. There is not a single defensive lineman from Minnesota right now that has a sack not named Carter Coughlin. And it's something to where I don't know how they fix it because Carter Coughlin has one move right now, or actually he's displaying multiple moves, which I think is a credit to Marcus West. And that's he can do the speed rush, which he's able to get the strip sack fumble on. But if Carter Coughlin isn't the one causing the pressure, the other 7 defensive linemen that Minnesota is rotating in aren't getting home. And with Tracy Clays and Jay Sauvel, you saw that they were able to play man coverage on the outside for good or for bad. That puts those guys on islands, but they were able to be creative with their front 7 in terms of generating pressure. Nathan Stanley drops back 39 times against Minnesota. He is sacked once, and that can't continue to happen for this Gopher defense as they're going to go play Ohio State this weekend, but you still have winnable games in the schedule. So when you look at the pass rush specifically, Derek, what are you seeing?
Well, against Iowa, they didn't. It was a very light amount of blitzing in the game. I think their game plan, beyond just trying to stop the run. In the passing game, I think their game plan was to drop seven guys into cover, into zone coverage for most of the game, which they played a heavier amount of zone coverage than we've seen in other games.
Well, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, Derek, against Maryland and even in the non-conference games, didn't we see a ton of man in relative comparison to zone?
Yeah, I think this game you saw a lot more zone than you had. I think, you know, without charting the plays, Maryland was much closer to, you know, probably 50-50 or definitely more man coverage. This game was more zone. And so to your point about the pass rush, then you're relying on your front four to generate a pass rush. And many times they'd play little games where they'd line up four in a rush position. They'd drop one of those guys, blitz a linebacker. But at the end of the day, you're still only rushing four. So if you can't get home with one of those guys, then you have to be confident that those seven you're dropping into coverage are going to drop and be able to break up passes and defend the pass. And that's where I think, to your point about the struggles they had on Saturday, I think I would use the word uncomfortable. It just looked like the Gophers' pass defense, especially in those zones, looked very uncomfortable. They had a few breakdowns, three or four breakdowns, one of them key breakdown, but even beyond that, at times when they were dropping to the right zones, they were getting to their part of the field, they just weren't defending tight on passes. And so I don't know, you know, without the benefit of being at practice or, right, you know, talking to those guys, I don't know if it's that they're not repping this enough in practice, or perhaps Iowa gave them looks in the passing game that they weren't comfortable with. But it definitely, they had difficulty defending, you know, when they dropped those guys into coverage, actually breaking up passes and playing tighter coverage, like you mentioned on the fourth down, but then a couple of third and seven, third and eight, they're still playing off and giving up the, you know, those first downs underneath. So it was frustrating. And you know, lastly, I would just say, give a little bit of credit to Iowa's offense, or actually more than a little credit.
For sure.
They really clicked on a lot I don't think the Gophers were expecting them to do as well in the passing game as they did. And that's a credit to them. So it's not an excuse for the Gophers defense, but going back and looking at the film, I mean, they clicked on some zone passing plays and hit some pockets, really, again, take advantage of that coverage. And so it was a combination of the two, but with a four-man pass rush, if Carter Coughlin's not able to get home, too much time for the quarterback to pick apart, you know, with some of these zone busting routes and find the soft spot in the zone. And that's what they did.
I mean, you mentioned being uncomfortable, and I agree with that from watching the tape back. And if you want to go watch the GIF rewinds, you can head on over to Gopher Illustrated to do so. But uncomfortable is such a nice word to describe it, because you mentioned, I don't understand why they looked so uncomfortable at times, because zone coverage is not anything new to these defensive backs. You're a Division I, Big Ten defensive back. You've played zone in high school. You've played zone in games. And that's where it comes back down to, if Minnesota, you know, if Rob Smith was surprised, and I don't know, because as we record this, the media has not met with Rob Smith, at how uncomfortable these defensive backs looked in coverage, they must have been much more aggressive and much more comfortable in practice, you would think. But it's perplexing as to why so many defensive backs, not named Jacob Huff, were so tentative at times in this zone coverage. And I don't really have an answer for that, Derek, other than maybe when the lights came on, things didn't go as planned, but Minnesota really didn't tend to deviate from that plan of playing a lot more zone coverage as far as I saw. Derek, is that true?
Well, yeah, I guess the only thing I could add to that is usually the last part of a defensive back, specifically the last part of their game to develop, is playing the ball on the ball. So once the ball is left the quarterback's hands, playing that ball, getting those jumps, getting the pass breakups. And that's not just a maturity thing, you know, where young guys aren't as good as sometimes it takes a player 3 years to develop that final part of the game, you know? So like you mentioned, they've got to know where their zone drops are. They've got to be able to diagnose the play that's being run on offense and know, okay, I'm going to see a crossing route here. I'm going to see a tight end stop route, be able to diagnose that. And then the third part is to be able to make a play on the ball. And that's the part that was missing. Kind of ironically, Terrell Smith is already developing that part of his game, you know, pretty well, where he's able to diagnose some of those plays, and he has the speed to make a break on the ball and make a play on the ball. So I guess that's the part of it I think that's missing. And again, specifically some of those zone drops in the game, you saw those guys drop in, whether they're having difficulty diagnosing the play or they're just not making the breaks on the ball. Again, they're giving up those catches. So it's kind of a mystery at this point, but it was definitely a big factor on Saturday.
Okay, I think we do have to give the Gopher defense some credit in the fact that they were able to, once again, a second season in a row, more or less hold the Iowa running attack in check, 40 carries for 106 yards. Neither of the three, kind of the three-headed monster that they have at running back, exceeded 50 yards. They all averaged under 4 yards a carry, which is great. A vast improvement from what we saw against Maryland. Additionally, I think the other thing that I'd like to turn out, that this defense did turn Iowa over twice. As Ryan alluded to, Carter Coughlin with a strip sack, Thomas Barber with the recovery, and as well, Jacob Huff again with an interception. At the end of the day, they lose the take-give, but they were able to force a couple of turnovers, especially in some meaningful situations, which we'll probably touch on in a little bit more detail when we talk about some of the coaching decisions. But that said, I mean, they had a couple bright moments in this game defensively, and we should highlight that in some way.
I think they obviously did. They stopped the Iowa running attack 2 years in a row. The issue is, I mean, is that a positive? Absolutely. Last year, they limited Iowa. Iowa only scored 17 points. Iowa comes back another year older with Nathan Stanley, Noah Fant, TJ Hawkinson, and Minnesota holds them under 100 yards rushing the ball. But Iowa passes for 300 yards and 4 touchdowns, and they put up 48 points at TCF Bank Stadium. Were there some bright spots? Absolutely. We talked about Carter Coughlin. He leads the team in sacks. I think he's tied for the team lead with Blake Cashman in tackles for loss. Carter Coughlin continues to be one of the twitchiest defensive ends or defensive players I've seen in a Golden Gopher uniform in quite some time. You look at even on what was a big play for Iowa that I know that Derek highlighted on his Twitter at Derek_S_Burns, where Iowa gets a big play. Carter Coughlin chases it down. He gains on the Iowa running back to make the tackle 15, 20 yards down the field. And I hope people can appreciate Carter Coughlin while he's here, while he's making plays consistently now, each and every week. But other than that, I mean, Thomas Barber at times really came downhill well, really made a thud on the ball, made these Iowa ball carriers think twice about coming. But for me anyway, Derek, and maybe it's the cynic that this Minneapolis and Minnesota sports market is making me, there's just, when you give up 48 points, and I know that there was, again, a lot to be made about, well, maybe this Gopher offense didn't give the defense ideal field position times. Iowa had 16 drives on the day, and only one of them started within Minnesota's 45. On the day, both Minnesota and Iowa had the same starting field position, and that was their own 31. I really don't want to hear a whole lot about it. Was there one time where Minnesota didn't get great field position? Absolutely. But then Nathan Stanley threw it right back to them. So, Derek, positive side of things, maybe you can be a little bit more rosy about it than I can.
Well, yeah. I mean, to kind of continue with our theme here, in run defense from the front seven of the Gophers looked completely comfortable defending the run, as maybe as good as we've ever seen them, in at least the past several years, if not a decade, defending Iowa's running game. They've been running the same offensive running schemes for 20 years, but that doesn't mean they're not good at them. They do bring in recruit to that. They bring in talent to be able to run inside outside zone, with the exception of outside zone stretch play to the weak side, which the Gophers had a lineup issue there, weren't able to fix that during the game. They got hit 6 or 7 times at that play. With that being the exception, the Gophers looked very comfortable up front, very aggressive, very physical, read their keys quickly and were able to come downhill fast, make plays, in the backfield, short yardage plays, second and third and short, played very well. So it is a credit to guys like Barber and Huff, and even Dulade Boudere had some flashes in run defense. So, if that hadn't been there, then, you're looking at a different game script where I was able to control the ball more. It's probably a lower score on both sides. Minnesota doesn't get as many attempts, you know, on offense, and that changes things. And they're able to, Iowa wants to win these games, you know, 17-10. That's how they like to play them. So, unfortunately, again, we touched on what happened in the passing game, but they did get it done, I thought, up front in the front seven and run defense.
All right. I don't know if we have anything else we really want to hit on defense. I'll give you guys a last word before we transition to offense. If you have anything, Ryan, you got anything?
I think we do need to talk about the mishap on the 60-yard play there. I know that PJ talked about it afterwards. Derek highlighted it on his Twitter. It's on YouTube as well. If folks want to get a visual and audio description of it. But Derek, do you want to run us through? Because to my eyes, Minnesota is sitting in zone. Terrell Smith is on par with everybody else there. It looks like Minnesota is running cover three, and which means that there's three deep safeties that have, I guess, three, all, you know, thirds of the field. So Antonio Chenault is the victim here as he gets caught up on a route up the seam, doesn't realize that Brandon Smith, the Iowa receiver, is behind him. And it's a wide open throw for Nate Stanley after Minnesota's pressure isn't able to get home again. But Derek, you did a fantastic job of explaining it there. Would you like to involve our listeners here?
Sure. Yeah, it was at Gophers ended up showed blitz, so they looked like they were going to be aggressive. But to our point earlier, only ended up rushing four. So they ended up dropping one of their linemen. And I think they brought Cashman on a blitz. Cashman almost got home. If that's not the correct player, I apologize. But one of the Gopher receivers almost got home, caused a pressure on the quarterback. The four middle defenders dropped into a zone right at the first down sticks. So that middle layer of the zone defense did their job. They got depth right to the first down marker to try and stop anything over the middle or to the sidelines right at that first down marker. And then the Gophers played deep thirds, which, as you pointed out, is, you know, one safety in the middle of the field, two on the outside. They take anything to their third of the field. And Iowa was able to get the receiver behind that middle portion of the zone at the first down, sneak that guy behind the corner. The Gopher safety in that third of the field got caught up, trying to defend the Iowa tight end on a seam route. I got to imagine that this week in practice, they've really hammered home the Iowa tight ends. Not to get beat by them, to keep the safety over those guys, even double team at times. I think they became preoccupied on that play and didn't see the wide receiver sneak behind on the sideline. They ran four go routes, which is really the perfect play call for something like a deep thirds coverage, and they got burned. Reason that play works is, again, the quarterback is able to elude the rush, create time, allow those receivers to get downfield, and made a really nice throw to the sidelines, to the top of the field, wide open receiver. He had a coverage bust. The play was extended, and he's able to get in for a touchdown.
All right, let's transition, talk a little bit of offense here. I think the things that are going to stick out to people would stick out if you look statistically at the box score. Number one is going to be the four turnovers. Three interceptions by Anixted, one by Seth Green. I don't know if that bugs me as much as it might bug some people, just because a lot of these were, you know, deep shots. We've talked about this on the podcast in length. You know, taking those deep shots in some ways is effectively just as good as a punt. It keeps the defense honest, etc. That sticks out. I guess the other thing to me, again, which Ryan, you've kind of already alluded to, Anixted being, five carries for minus 31 is going to stick out pretty bad. He's obviously under a decent amount of duress, number of sacks that he had to take, which impacts your total rush yardage in general. Again, it was a challenge at times for the offensive line, but they did make a change that ultimately led to at least some stability in that second half.
It did. They were inserted Daniel Fa'alele in at right tackle after Anthony Nelson nearly had five sacks or more in the first half. He ends up the day with three. He gets Big Ten Player of the Week. And Derek, you being a former Big Ten offensive lineman, a former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, you and I have talked about, and Luke, we've talked about how Sam Schluter doesn't need to be great. He just needed to be average. And he wasn't able to do so in Anthony Nelson single-handedly derailed Minnesota's offense on multiple drives. where Minnesota has a couple of chunk plays, and then Anthony Nelson turns the corner. And my big thing, Derek, with Sluter's play in the first half was against Maryland. It was a lot of it on the bull rush. Sam Sluter was put on skates. Well, against Iowa, Anthony Nelson maybe got home once on a bull rush, but it was a lot on, to me anyway, and you're the offensive line guru, and I can't wait to get your thoughts, that Sluter wasn't exactly punching. He was lunging. And Anthony Nelson saw that, and he swam it, and it was a free run to the quarterback. So when you saw Sam Sluter's play in the pass against Iowa, what went wrong?
Yeah, that's you. Couple things working against him, and I'm not trying to make excuses for the young man, but we have to remember a couple things. One is the Gopher offense. I think they want to be a drop back passing offense. They want to give time for these downfield routes, and in order to do that, you're going to need to call a lot of man pass blocking schemes, and you're going to have to block for a long time. So that's something, part of the identity I think this offense wants to have, and that's going to put you in a position where you're having to pass block long, and you're having to go one-on-one with the DN quite a bit. The second thing in this game, as we mentioned, they got off to a start, you know, they're in the hole, so they're trying to come back, which puts you in more obvious passing situations. Interestingly, if you watch the game, even through the third quarter, if the Gophers passed on first and 10, they really never had any protection issues. So on a traditional running down where Iowa didn't have their ears pinned back, you know, was not bringing extra pressure, they didn't have many problems. But you're put in a situation where you are into more obvious passing situations, you're down early, and you have an offense that wants to generate downfield routes. That made it difficult, you know, at tackle. So specifically, you touched on it. It wasn't necessarily the bull rush this game. It was the setting up and the punch, which, you know, he wants to extend, get good position, but then on your punch, you have to keep your head and your shoulders back and punch with your arms, punch and lock out your arms. If you're moving forward and getting your shoulders over your knees, you're going to be susceptible to a pull, or if you miss your punch, he's going to go right by you. So it's tough. Defensive end, a very athletic position. They're fast. It's a tough matchup, and you know, they struggled with those kind of three things working against him early in the game.
And I thought that Minnesota kept in a tight end or a running back to that side at times, even on one of the sacks that Anthony Nelson had. Minnesota's tight end gets him on the first shot and he doesn't get it. Sluter gets into his kick there, goes to get Anthony Nelson, lunges, Nelson swims him, and Anixted maybe probably held the ball a little bit too long.
Yeah.
And he gets sacked. But it's so tough to – were a couple of these sacks on Zach Anixted not the offensive line? Absolutely. Were some of these sacks on the fact that Zach Anixted never had a chance?
Yep.
Absolutely. And so the question mark now becomes, now that the genie's out of the bottle, Daniel Faalele, outside of that opening drive where he looked like a fish out of water, he has a false start, I don't think he made any of the blocks on that opening drive. You saw the remainder of the game, the talent that this young man has. I think, in my opinion, he is one of the most powerful individuals Minnesota's had on their offensive line in quite some time. He made Anthony Nelson on a few different run plays just look like he was going against an eighth grader. And Anthony Nelson is a gigantic individual. I think he's all a 6'6", 275 pounds. And that's where you can see the long-term bright future for Faalele, where if he gets his hands on you, you're not going anywhere you want to. You're only going where Daniel Faalele wants you to. So the question for PJ Fleck now becomes, are you just going to burn the redshirt of Faalele? Now, in my opinion, I say you do, because I don't think that Daniel Faalele with a redshirt year is here all four of those, the next 4 years after that. I think, especially with the state of the NFL offensive line and how they're desperate for bodies, Daniel Faalele, I cannot imagine, is going to be here 5 years, which I'm happy to say about a Gopher offensive lineman for once, considering they haven't had an offensive lineman drafted since 2006. But the question becomes for the both of you, and Luke, I guess let's start with you. What do you do if you're PJ Fleck? Because he talked about it after the game. He's got a decision to make now because the genie's out of the bottle. Daniel Faalele, I thought, for considering the circumstance of which he came in, especially in the run game, played very well. Now, he got help from tight ends. He got help from running backs at times as well. But I thought he certainly was an improvement over what we saw from Sam Schluter. So if you're PJ Fleck, you have seven Big Ten games to go. Is Daniel Falalele's first career start going to be this weekend against Ohio State, which is certainly not fair to him? And do you burn the redshirt?
You know, it's a great question, and it's part of what makes this new redshirt rule really fascinating, right? Just from a strategic standpoint, what are coaches going to do? It brings a lot more questions into play. So number one with Falalele, for me, I think the sample size at this point is really hard to judge, mostly because I haven't been at practice either, and maybe Ryan, you can speak to this a little bit more, but I don't know how he's going to do in the pass in terms of pass blocking. I understand that he's going to be probably a pretty big sizable upgrade at the running spot. At the end of the day, if you are going to lose, if you're thinking he's not going to be a 5-year player, you play him, right? Because the chances that if he's not going to be a 5-year player, he could be another Max Williams situation where you only have him for 2 years, right? Really two full playing years. So I guess from that perspective, I think you play him. And the other thing that really comes into question here for me is, how do you project that you're going to recruit? If you're going to continue to recruit better players, my opinion is you play the best player available. If you don't think you are, and you think that recruiting is going to taper off at a certain point, then you got to play for moments, right, where you're playing for a single season. And that's probably why they made the switch to PJ Fleck in the first place, because you had a Jerry Kill-led staff that was basically playing for certain seasons, right? They played for the 9-win seat, or the whatever bowl, the New Year's Day bowl. Citrus Bowl. They played for another the year that Tracy Clays was the head coach. That was supposed to be the year that they were supposed to, you know, compete for a Big Ten championship. If you brought PJ Fleck in to recruit better talent and better talent, you got to play him. That's my opinion. Derek, you're much more wise when it comes to offensive line, so I'm desperately curious to hear your opinion.
Well, a couple things I guess I could add is, you know, with the new redshirt rule, you don't have to declare anything. So
right.
This could be a situation where whether they play him next week at Ohio State or not, this could be a situation where you play him in two more games, give a better sample size, and then make the determination. So they don't need to declare anything right away. They can have intentions, of course. And with each game that he plays, you know, you're traveling further down that road, of course. But it could be something where you give him, see how he does in different situations and give him more looks, you know, and play him in another game and see how that goes. And although none of us would want to see this, if there's something that he really struggles with, that the coaches feel that he really needs another year of work in order to be able to compete every snap, as a starting right tackle, then you make that determination and you redshirt him. The only other thing I would add is there are some things they can do schematically to help him out. Everybody always talks about using an H-back or a tight end or running back to chip. They can also do things like running slide protection on that side, give him less of a man-to-man protection. And doesn't mean they have to eliminate it, but, you know, instead of putting him in a situation where he's you know, 15 to 20 times a game having to block man pass blocking on the defensive end, maybe you cut that down to 5 or 7, you know, schematically. You do some things to help them out a little bit.
Can't they do that with Schluter too? Like it feels like they're almost refusing to do that.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think they, Derek, again, you're more knowledgeable.
They started to do that actually with about 4 or 5 minutes left to go in the first half of this game. They started to show a little bit more slide protection. Now, still, as the game went on, they did go back and run more man protection. But that was something we talked about on last week's breakdown, that I was surprised they hadn't done more of that. And one of the reasons why is that with slide protection, drop back that works better with that as a sprint out or a bootleg. So without the mobility, maybe at quarterback with the ankle injury, they're probably a little less likely to run slide protection, but you can still run slide protection with drop back passing. It just takes another guy out of a pass pattern because he has to block the front side of the slide. So it's not impossible, but again, it goes back to what we've talked about over the years of this podcast is, are you are you fitting the scheme to the players? Are you fitting the players to the scheme? I don't think they want to be necessarily be a slide protection, bootleg, naked, sprint out passing team. I think they want to be a drop back passing team. So maybe there's a compromise in there. And if you play them, again, you take them from 20 man-to-man drop back passing plays a game, and you bump them down to 5 or 10 schematically.
All right, so let's maybe move away from offensive line talk. Let's just maybe highlight a few of the things that stood out in this game. I guess for me, in Big Ten play, if you don't think that Rashad Bateman's standing out and you don't see the potential, I don't know what you're watching, because to me, he looks like the real deal as a true freshman. I'm probably in that camp. If he continues his maturation and growth, he might be another guy that's not here for three or not here all 4 years, Ryan.
I hope that's certainly the case. But if to Luke's point, and I talked about it with Justin Gard on KFAN Sunday morning, if you're looking at this offense and you're not seeing optimism and hope and young guys playing well, you're just certainly not, number one, looking hard enough, or two, accepting the fact that for the first time, I think, since I started covering this team in 2011, this is a Gopher offense that has not one viable wide receiver, not two viable Big Ten wide receivers, but three Big Ten viable wide receivers. Oh, by the way, all three of them are back in 2019, and two of the three will be back for 2020. This is, for the first time, like I said, you have three legitimate Big Ten wide receivers, and they're playing like it as such. Rashad Bateman goes 7 catches for 65 yards and 2 scores. The good Tyler Johnson shows up, 6 catches for 107 and a score. And Chris Ottman-Bell continues to make routine catches, but are, by the way, really, really hard. Very tough contested catches, 50-50 balls across the middle with a safety bearing down on you, and he's a freshman. You're seeing the growth from this receiving core, and I can't help but be excited to think about 2019, even though I hate to do it because 7 Big Ten games left. But imagine this passing game next year with Anixtead another year older, Rashad Bateman, Tyler Johnson, Chris Ottman-Bell another year older, and then you're throwing in 2 proven Big Ten quality running backs in Shannon Brooks and Rodney Smith. Let's go.
Let's not overlook the fact that Shannon Brooks still potentially could play this season, thanks to that.
Shannon Brooks will play this.
Right.
Shannon Brooks will play in 4 games this season. The question is going to be, which 4 games are those? But this receiving core, you can't help but look at it and be optimistic. And looking at even for 2019, you're going to get Jornell Manns, someone that I know Minnesota is extremely high on. You get Nnamdi Adeem, Matthew Mayer. We talk about these tunnel screens and these Minnesota receivers being tentative to be physical. Nnamdi ain't going to be afraid to be physical at his size and stature at 6'4", 240 pounds. This is the kind of guy that you were envisioning Seth Green to be, which, by the way, still mind blown. Seth Green, Minnesota's best 50-50 ball winner in fall camp, still doesn't have a target through 5 games, and Anixtead's throwing the ball somewhere between 27 and 33 times a game. But Derek, seemingly since we've had you on this podcast, it's been after every Big Ten game, we talk about Minnesota's receivers aren't winning 50-50 balls, these back shoulder fades, these contested catches, route running. Again, you're probably more unbiased than me in this sort of aspect because I've gotten to know these guys through the recruiting process, but you can't help but be optimistic about these three guys. Am I right?
Oh, definitely. If you know, the game on Saturday, the bright spot was definitely the fact that Iowa's corners, Iowa's secondary could not match up with the Gophers' wide receivers. They wanted to, you know, they like their offensive philosophy. They've had the same defensive schemes for the better part of a couple decades, and they want to play cover 2. They want to play aggressive with their corners because they're going to leave 2 safeties in the middle of the field. What Minnesota did is attack the outside, attack those corners with the go routes and the back shoulder routes away from the safeties, so they didn't throw anything like a post or much, you know, deep over the field. And Iowa couldn't match up. So that's what you want to have on offense, is you want to have a strength. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's power running or down the field throws or, you know, West Coast offense, crossing routes. You want to have a strength that forces the defense to change their game plan and to adjust to that And then that will in turn open up things elsewhere in the offense. So Iowa did end up, you know, in the first probably quarter and a half of the game, we're not able to match up. They did make some adjustments. They ended up blitzing a bit more, which is uncharacteristic for Iowa, try and get some pressure so the Gophers couldn't get those guys downfield. And then they did adjust the technique of their corners throughout the game, ended up getting a couple interceptions out of it. And it was Minnesota, I think, is going to go back and look at that. And there's some things they could have done to counter that. But yeah, it was good to see the Gophers developing a strength on the offense. It's going to force defenses to change what they're doing. And that's going to, you know, have a domino effect and open up some things throughout the rest of their offense.
All right, we have to talk a little bit about Anikstad. Again, his line this week was 17 for 33, 218 yards through the air. That's an average of 6.6 yards, three touchdown passes, which is great, but he also had three interceptions. I think that, you know, now he's got, what, five interceptions through two Big Ten games. You know, some of that pressure induced, some of it, you know, he's very obviously not 100%. You got to give him credit for being a gritty guy and playing through the ankle injury. Again, a true freshman, walk on, whatever you want to say. I think he's definitely a sizable improvement from years past. But again, he has had some struggles. And at this point, they're not screaming for the backup quarterback, which is great, other than when they bring in the backup quarterback to run the Wildcat. But curious to get your guys' thoughts around, or let's start with Derek. Derek, what are your thoughts on Anikstad and his performance, at least in this Iowa game?
Yeah, I think definitely on some of those back shoulder throws, some of the down the field routes looked better in this game. I know Ryan's mentioned that he's been pretty money in practice and has struggled a bit more in the games. I think that at least early on in this game looked a little bit better. And you know, he's going to make some mistakes. You know, he made one bad down the field throw for interception. It was just a bad throw and a bad read. He threw into double coverage. Safety ended up picking it off. And I know that he's taking some sacks where he really should throw it away, try and run out of bounds. But I'm going to give a little bit of a dissenting opinion on that. It's my opinion anyway, that if you look at some of these really good quarterbacks in college and the NFL, their ability to extend plays is what creates chunk plays, is what creates big plays. So I actually happen to like quarterbacks that will try and extend plays and try and keep their eyes downfield, whether it's scrambling, stepping up in the pocket. He's got to work on his technique with that a little bit, but I actually like the fact that he doesn't cover up at the first sign of pressure, doesn't throw it away right away, doesn't throw the ball on the ground. It's cost him a couple times, but what you hope there, especially against some of these teams they're going to see throughout the rest of the year that play tight press man coverage, if you extend those plays, that's where you're going to see guys get open later in the play, and many times those are big plays. So it's frustrating sometimes for us to watch, and I know, you know, me along with everyone else, at least two different times, frustrating to take a big sack trying to extend the play, but you got to believe that's going to pay dividends. And I guess my personal opinion, I'd rather have him erroring on that side than someone who's scared in the pocket and antsy in the pocket.
That's a great point. And one of the reasons I'm so happy you brought you on is that's a perspective I guess I hadn't thought of, and it makes so much sense for the state of Minnesota's offense right now, which struggles immensely to generate big plays. You look at this offense coming into the Iowa game, I believe they were a bottom 15 unit in all of college football in terms of gaining explosive plays. And then you look at them on the day, they only had two plays over 20 yards on offense. And so that's one of the big ways that you can have that happen. We saw it against Fresno State. Zach Anikstad scrambles out of a sack, keeps the play alive, throws it to Tyler Johnson. The entire game was flipped momentum-wise on that play specifically. Now, Zach Anikstad still need to throw the ball away at times where he's looking down the field and he knows that no one's there. And he's just trying to extend the play. At some point, that clock in his head and that alarm clock that's going beep, 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 I got to throw the ball, that's got to continue to go off, and he's got to throw it away and live to see another down, especially if it's 2nd and 10. You don't want to take the sack there and have it be 3rd and 21 instead of 3rd and 10, because the play card for Kurt Ciarocki gets even smaller. Now, Zach Anikstad, I'll continue to say, when he has time, he's making deliberate, or he's making accurate throws that are delivered on time. The next thing for him to improve on outside of that pocket awareness in terms of being able to throw the ball away, in my opinion, is he's got to work off that first read because he's staring down those reads. Now, luckily for him, Minnesota finally has some talent in it, wide receiver that can get open from time to time. But even the route combinations on Derek, on that fourth down play where Minnesota did go for it, all the Iowa defensive backs on that play were shaded inside because they knew the slant was coming. It was fourth and five, Minnesota running the pass. Yep. And maybe that's an offensive schematic thing where Iowa knew this is what they're going to run on a third and short or a fourth and five in this kind of situation. And Kirk Schrock has got to mix it up. But for Zach Anikstead, now he has only played five collegiate games. These are, things that we talk about that we've talked about here so far are fixable things. He's five collegiate games in. He's a true freshman. You heard through reps and experience that these things continue to improve over the course of the 2018 season going into 2019. But would you agree that the whole first read, he's got to be able to work off of that, and especially as more tape gets out on him, these teams are really going to hone on that first read. Where does he traditionally go in these different sets, especially in today's age of all the different tape that's available, different things that Zach Anikstead needs to work on, Derek?
Yeah, there's two different phases for him. I think he does work off that read when he decides to scramble and they sort of go into scramble drill and the wide receivers come back. And then he does tend to scan the field. But I think what you're talking about is just on his drop back reads. Now it's a little bit tough on three step. You're looking for a quick hitting play.
Right.
You're not going to go through a full progression on that. You're probably going to check one side of the field and just check two different routes. And depending on how the defense reacts, you're going to choose your receiver and try and throw a dart. But yeah, in this five step drop, what's interesting is you kind of chuckle because sometimes as a fan, what's frustrating with other teams is the quarterbacks tend to check off a lot or check down a lot, especially in second and third and long situations. And he almost never checks down, which is interesting.
No.
He left a couple of guys, we're nitpicking here a little bit, but he left a couple of guys and a couple of check down guys wide open in the Iowa game because he's keeping his eyes upfield and he really wants to throw to his wide receivers.
What a time to be alive that we're complaining about or not. I shouldn't say complaining. We're nitpicking. Oh no, the Gopher quarterback, his eyes are too far down the field and he's not trying to go right. Sam Bradford on the bit to check it down. Just such a complete change from the most recent years.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It definitely is. And, but getting back to our the point we're trying to hammer home with is you're talking about a guy in his fifth game and he has a lot of game left to develop, especially at the quarterback position there's a lot left for him to develop in the passing game. And so that I would imagine would be one of those things for him to develop is, you're going to check your two receivers. And instead of going into scramble drill and rolling out and trying to hit one of those guys on a comeback, before you do that, check your wide receiver, or excuse me, check your tight end, check your running back. That guy might be in the flat wide open, 5 yard round. He's able to catch and run for a first down. So, hopefully those things come and he's able to develop that part of his game. But if you had to pick your poison, I think we're starting the right way where, he's not afraid to keep his eyes downfield. He's not using that check down as a crutch.
And to hammer this point home as well, some of those second half down the field throws that were intercepted, it was almost like PJ Fleck in the press conference afterwards was like, hey, I literally told him we're down 14. I don't really want to get a 7-play 60 yard drive that takes 6 minutes. We don't have the time. So I need you to force the issue. So then in my opinion, that comes at such a tough thing to know in terms of which throws in the second half were, hey, coach told me to force the ball down the field. I got to do that versus, he looks open. I should probably try to force it there. Two totally different things in terms of how many of these interceptions are, hey, I'm going to force it into double coverage no matter what, versus he didn't actually see that he was triple covered. You know what I mean? It's such a tough thing to try and evaluate, but is there a lot of things for Zach Anikstead still to work on? Absolutely. He's a true freshman. We've discussed that. But it's those little characteristics that have me optimistic in terms of this isn't what you've seen at quarterback in recent years, because number one, he has the arm talent to make some throws where it's like Mitch Leiner couldn't have made that throw as a senior. And number two, like to Derek's point, his eyes are remaining way down the field and he's not turning into checkdown. Now, is that going to get him in trouble? And are you going to see these multiple interception games? Absolutely. But in theory, as Minnesota hopefully gets in more positive game script situations or even neutral game script situations where they can mix in the run a little bit more and a little bit more, that's where you can see that these big plays hopefully will materialize.
Yeah, not to mention if he can just be healthy, right? He has been basically since Miami of Ohio basically more or less played hurt or for at least a portion or a good portion of each game. Okay, before we transition to another topic, I want to highlight our sponsor once again, which is the Goal Line Club. Want to promote a couple of events that are coming up here. Number one, if you haven't checked out the tailgate, I was there on Saturday with Ryan. It was a great time. A lot of folks there. Great environment, great atmosphere, great food, lots of beverages as well. Again, want to highlight, if you didn't notice, it's getting cold outside. You can be inside at this tailgate if you want to and need to. That is a great perk of this tailgate.
It is, and you think about the upcoming game, the next home game for Minnesota. It's a Friday night, October 26th against Indiana. Now, I know that my better half, if she were to come to a tailgate, number one, she doesn't want to deal with all the setup and all those different kinds of things. She doesn't want to deal with the cold weather, as we're certainly getting into that now. Well, that's the nice thing where at these GLC tailgates, number one, there's no setup involved. You park your car, you walked in front of Williams Arena, you go meet Bob Hughes, and you walk in and it's unlimited open bar. And you have a meal ticket. There's no hassle. It's heated, especially even if you have young kids that you want to have them experience a tailgate of sorts, but they're going to be cold. They're going to be complaining. You can literally go inside at Williams Arena. You have a table. You can sit down, enjoy all the beverages you want. The Gopher band comes and plays at times. It seemingly makes so much sense, especially as we get into October and November. It's going to get cold. You're going to find excuses. Your better half is going to find excuses to not want to tailgate. Well, if you can pitch them this idea where for non-members, I believe it's $45, or if you have children under the age of 18, you pay their age at the door. It's unlimited drinks. It's heated. And there's a bunch of Gopher fans there with a meal ticket.
Yeah,
makes way too much sense.
Yeah, not to mention, too, one thing that we haven't promoted yet, but you should really go check out, which is a great opportunity, is they do have a pregame preview for the game day. This one will take place Thursday, October 25th for the Indiana game. It's from 11:45 to 12:45. Again, sign up on goalineclub.org. There will be a position coach there. It takes place at the Delta Hotels. You need to register. Registration will close October 22nd at 1 p.m. Space is limited, but that is another event that you can take part of. Reasonably priced at, I think, $25 for members, $35 for non-members. It's all there on goalineclub.org. Go check it out. All right, so let's transition and talk a little bit about how much they featured the Wildcat here in the second half of this Iowa game. Derek, I'm curious to get your input as to maybe why they did that. I think there was a stretch there where Seth Green took a number of snaps in a row where Zach Anikstead just stood out, basically on the far sideline and watched and observed as they ran that zone read for Seth Green. I'm curious why they maybe did this, or what was the thought process in going to this Wildcat so much?
Well, I think a couple things. First is, in the running game, the Wildcat gets you an extra blocker. If they wanted to get anything going in the running game, they wanted to use that as an advantage. And Iowa typically does not play plus one in the box. That's not their identity. They play aggressive with their front seven, but they usually don't load the box. Those safeties will come down and run support quickly, but I think they wanted to try and to create a mismatch up front. But perhaps more importantly, it's my opinion anyway, that I think they wanted to try and keep the offense on the field a bit longer. I think looking at the way the game script had gone, a lot of passing by both teams, I think that perhaps they were concerned with keeping the defense on the field for majority of the second half. So in order to do that, you have to sustain some, you have to sustain the drive, you know, have some, put together some plays, some running plays that, you know, are going to chew up a little bit of clock. And so I think both of those things probably factored it, you know, factored in. They were able to keep the ball, you know, keep, stay out of a three and out situation, put themselves in a little bit better position for if they did get the third down, that it was third and two, third and three, as opposed to third and 10. So I think those things factored in, those three things probably factored into them going a little bit heavier in the Wildcat in the second half.
I agree, especially on that final drive of the third quarter. Minnesota's trying to get any kind of clock. That, as Derek said, that was the biggest thing I drew back to was, I think there was a conversation between P.J. Fleck, and this is just purely me speculating, P.J. Fleck, offensive coordinator Kirk Charaka, saying, our defense needs a little bit of time to, number one, get a breather, and number two, hopefully make some adjustments here. But for that to happen, we need them in front of the whiteboard for at least a couple minutes here. Can we get some first downs here to be able to implement these things? Now, that would make a lot of sense to me. You saw that Minnesota had some success there, and it felt like they ran it just a little too long on that drive where they have success. They're completing, you know, 8 yards at a chunk. They threw a slant to Tyler Johnson for the first yard, but then they had that 1 yard gain, that negative 1 yard gain, put themselves in a tough spot. Minnesota ends up going for it on that fourth and five, as I mentioned, and they weren't able to complete it as Iowa was playing the slants well. So it felt like they were trying to force the issue, especially on that next drive where first play, Minnesota goes Wildcat, but Seth Green, quarterback Seth Green, tries to air it out on a fade, and it's immediately picked off. And I know folks are continuing to clamor, and I don't understand why, for Seth Green at quarterback with Anikstead's ankle not there. If you're going to want to clamor for a quarterback, I don't understand why you're not clamoring for Tanner Morgan. Seth Green, the quarterback, isn't great. Seth Green, the quarterback, knows that. Seth Green's limited there. I think Seth Green, of all people, would tell you he wants to be featured in the passing game a little bit more and not just exclusively as the Wildcat, which, Luke, I think we talked about it at the tailgate before. How ironic is it that everybody's now clamoring for Seth Green at quarterback when it's literally all he's played this entire season, where folks still haven't been able to see Seth Green at receiver, which I know that's going to be a question I asked Kirk Charaka this week, is they had so much success with him at camp at receiver. Are you not putting him there just because you want him healthy to run the Wildcat, or what's the explanation?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that either. It is interesting. I, you know, and it all makes sense why they've gone to this Wildcat. You know, some coaching, some other coaching things that we probably have to discuss, because there are a couple, you know, I don't know if questionable is the right word, but there are ones that people are going to question, whether that's on Twitter, you know, or at their tailgate afterwards or the party afterwards when they're talking about the game. A couple that stick out to me, the fake punt. I didn't actually hate it. I know, Ryan, you weren't a huge fan of it. But you know,
okay, if you're gonna say that, you gotta let me provide context, but I'll provide it. You go ahead.
I didn't hate it. You know, I actually kind of liked it. I'm not sure I loved they couldn't execute, obviously, but I'll let you defend your at least question of calling that fake.
Yeah, I got four different things coaching wise that I want each one of your opinions on that I talked about in my five takeaway piece on Gopher Illustrated, and we'll get to them. But the first one was the fake punt call. I have no issue in Minnesota going for it here in terms of the distance and the situation. You're down 11 in the first half. You're struggling to come up with a big play. I just question, why are we having the punter throw a 40-yard fade? Now, I understand that Jacob Herbers is a member of the Golden Gopher baseball team, and he has a cannon. You were able to see that. But wouldn't you, instead of just having him throw the fade, why don't you have him throw a post? It's 20 yards shorter. It's still a timing route, something you can still work on in practice. And Fleck talked about it afterwards. You know, they converted it the last 2 weeks relentlessly in practice, and then they didn't execute it in the game, and he took responsibility for that. I have no issue with the call that you're going to have a fake punt. I have the issue with, why is it 40 yards on a fade instead of 20 yards on a post, where in theory you can still have Chris Ottman-Bell be wide open because the gunner on the outside for Iowa is just going to be thinking, oh, he's going to defend the punt, and then he's going to break inside and he's going to be wide open and no one's going to be there. Now, Derek, I guess if you're going to pick a side between Luke and I, which side of the coin are you on in the fake punt call?
Well, I didn't have any issue with the call either. It's a rivalry game. You're down. It's nice to see them be aggressive. I got to say, I haven't seen that type of fake punt throw before. Usually your fake punts are trying to take advantage of a scheme that the defense is playing, get somebody uncovered, and then hit them wide open, you know, in the middle of the field, or, you know, hide somebody in the formation and then have that person leak out for a pass. That's usually what you see. The only thing I can say is, you're right. They must have repped that a lot in practice and been comfortable with it. And the only thing I'll add is they may have, you know, hoped for a pass interference, because usually the punt defender isn't thinking pass. And so sometimes he can run into the offensive guy, but and draw a pass interference. But yeah, it was wasn't something I had seen before. He actually threw a pretty decent ball, but I get what you're saying in that it's a low completion percentage play. But you know, I go back to, they had to have repped it in practice and been comfortable with it in order to call it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some other coaching decisions. I guess one that's going to stick out to most people is, you know, you seemingly stop Iowa near the goal line. They're going to kick a field goal. They go swinging gate, convert that for a touchdown. Derek, your thoughts there on maybe not the timeout, you know, what goes into whether or not they execute the swinging gate or not. Curious to get your thoughts there.
Yeah, they must have been comfortable with the numbers they had. Now, when I went back and looked at it, I thought they had one too many over the center, but it depends on what their scheme is going to be to defend that. I thought they needed one more on the gate formation that they ended up. And usually what happens, well, it's not often called. What happens is usually the kicking team will read the numbers, and then if they like the numbers, they'll actually make a call on the field to make that a pass. So the coach will give them that option as they're leaving the play. They'll come out and say, okay, we're going to run this, and if you see these numbers, go ahead and pass it, or I don't know if I can call it a lateral, go ahead and rush it anyway. But the Gophers must have liked the numbers, because they didn't call the timeout. The disappointing thing was how they defended it. They apparently liked the numbers, but they didn't set the edge on the outside. So if they've repped that in practice, you need to set the edge on the outside, you know, get your pursuit from the middle of the field to chase that down and make the tackle before it's a touchdown. So it wasn't defended very well. The last thing I would say is, you could, if you're not 100% comfortable, you can call the timeout and hope that takes Iowa out of that play. So you call the timeout, and then Iowa goes back, huddles, and then comes out and just says, hey, we're going to kick the field goal, because they took it. We made them burn a timeout, but that's fine. We'll just go ahead and kick the field goal. So ultimately, you're judged by the result. It wasn't a good result. But they must have been comfortable enough to not call the timeout.
You stole my thunder, you son of a gun. Those are literally my 2 points. Was, if I wanted the timeout there. Now, Fleck said we had everybody lined up in the postgame press conference. He's talking about this swinging gate play, which, first point, how ironic is it that when Kirk Ferentz gets tricky, the old school man that he is, he goes with a swinging gate, not some kind of new age trick play. He goes with the swinging gate, which has been along for countless years. Number two, Fleck talked about in the press conference afterwards how he didn't call the timeout because they were prepared for it. He thought everybody knew their responsibility. They just didn't execute setting the edge, as Derek said, which they didn't. But my question is, how are you expecting Chris Williamson at 6 foot, 190 pounds, to be able to set the edge against a blocker who had 80 plus pounds on him? In what scenario in practice is Chris Williamson winning that at such a high rate where you think he's going to be able to jump outside and not get dominated back inside, or even back to the neutral to the field there, where TJ Hockenson isn't going to be able to turn the corner? I question that of anything. Is, yes, Minnesota didn't set the corner, but to ask Chris Williamson to set the corner on a lineman that had 80 pounds on him is such a tough ask for me. So that's where exactly I would have called the timeout, because I'm working under the impression that if you call the timeout there, Kirk Ferentz isn't going to go back to that play again. You're going to save yourself 4 points, and you're going to be able to keep the ball game closer. So for those reasons, that's where, even if this team was lined up correctly, which I Fleck adamantly says they were, I'd still have called the timeout.
Yeah, I still, I don't know if I agree with you on the blocking piece. I just don't think Williamson played his key correctly. I think at the end of the
it is truly the swinging gait, which Fleck talked about, that this was something they practice every day.
Yeah,
last month. How does Chris Williamson not know to set the edge there?
Well, there's a plethora of ways that you can run, you know, that from, or plethora of plays you can run out of that formation. I think, you know, Derek, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, what I was always taught was that outside guy is supposed to get upfield and force him inside. And there's no way that dude man 80 plus pounds is going to block Chris Williamson. Like, he's going to get a body into him. He's going to be able to force it inside. That's what Williamson didn't do, but.
That's where, if Williamson truly didn't know that he was setting it inside, I think that's solely his, like you said, his sole responsibility is the outside man on the swinging gate, which,
yeah,
you would have told me prior to this podcast we'd be getting into swinging gate dynamics and strategies, I would have laughed at you. But if that is literally his sole responsibility, which I tend to believe, considering the guy he was lined up across was 80 plus pounds heavier than him and had a lineman number on, why didn't he immediately jet upfield to force that inside? So if he wasn't prepared, like Fleck says that they talked about, they run it every day, why wasn't he prepared? It doesn't make sense to me. So I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't have any idea either. I guess coaching stuff, I know, Ryan, you touched on the not going for it on the Gopher Zone 44 and instead turning to punt. I know that that's somewhat a moot point for some people because of strip sack that followed afterwards. I know you didn't love the call, but, you know, okay, so on paper, on the card, for you, given that situation, that's an obvious got to go for it.
You can't, and it's funny that the hindsight or 2020 people were arguing with me, well, Minnesota got a strip sack and forced a turnover, so why wouldn't they just punt it every time? You literally cannot play that. You can't bank on the fact that, oh, we're just going to pin them deep and force a turnover. This is a go. There was literally the only sack of the day. There's 39 dropbacks. They struggled to get pressure immensely the entire game. They only rushed four, and Carter gets a strip sack fumble. You can't play that because that's only going to happen maybe 10, 15% of the time, if that. You have to be aggressive. You're down double-digit points. You're on the Iowa 44. It's not like it was 4th and 17. I believe it was 4th and 4. So Fleck had gone for this in different situations in the previous four games, and that's what I'm upset about, is you go for it in situation. Minnesota even went for it on a 4th and 5 later in the game. Now, was it 10 yards further into Iowa territory? Sure. You're not going to kick a field goal there. Well, if you're not going to kick a field goal there, you shouldn't punt on that same situation 10 yards away when the game score is that exact same way. Now, maybe that's the aggressive person in me saying, if you don't play to win the game, you're not going to win the game. But Derek, the situation is Iowa. You're on Iowa's 44. It's 4th and 5. You're down double-digit points in the second half. Now, again, it worked out in hindsight, but you can't bank on that, in my opinion. What is your opinion?
I don't. A couple things. Just trying to go through what the coaching staff's thinking there is. They're definitely not banking on a turnover. I don't think. I think you're correct there, but. Perhaps they believe they wanted to put Iowa, pin them way back and force them to go the length of the field. Now, that kind of flies in the face of what we just said a few minutes ago, which is trying to keep the defense off the field and off of long drives and having that offense stay on there. So maybe that's not what they're thinking. I don't know. The only other thing I can think is given the down and distance, maybe they didn't have a play they liked in that situation. That's also a bit far-fetched. I mean, 4th and 4, 4th and 5, you should have a number of things that you feel good about, especially in that part of the field. But I'm not sure. It did work out for them. It's sometimes during the game, I think, you know, people overlook being a fan as you're repping off play after play after play, and you get in a situation, you're perhaps not ready. You don't have something loaded in, so you're not ready to go. That's something that the head coach radios up and says, hey, you got something for this. If we go for it, and, you know, if they don't like it or not ready, then they end up punting it. So a lot of things could have happened. I'm just trying to, you know, go through what might have happened there. But, yeah, I think it's that part of the field in that game situation, you're down. I don't think it's a big risk, and you should have something, you know, in a fourth and medium, should have something that you like in the playbook that you can go to with a decent rate of conversion.
You know, in that situation too, one thing I'd be curious to know, it felt like, I don't have the stats to back this up, but it did feel like in that situation of the game, Iowa had struggled in any long sustained drives. They had really made their money on the shorter fields at that point. I just feel that I don't have anything to back that up. So maybe that played into the decision. Oh, one other coaching thing I wanted to get into. I feel like this is kind of becoming a trend in these breakdowns. The Mo Ibrahim Bryce Williams argument here, for lack of a better description for it. Mo Ibrahim on the day, 13 carries, 62 yards, 4.8 average, long of 11. Bryce Williams, 5 carries, 28, 5.6, 13. I'm currently of the opinion that they play Mo Ibrahim strictly for pass protection at this point. I don't know.
He was sensational in pass protection. I know he's. Which I'm sure some listeners are thinking, is that Ryan Burns actually being kind to Mo Ibrahim?
Which, I know you get a lot of flack for this. He was fantastic in pass pro. And at this point, part of me is just wondering, they play him more strictly so that they're not showing their hand. I other than that, I don't know, Derek, what are you seeing? Because I think that we're probably all in agreement, maybe not. Bryce Williams is the better runner, but, you know, in terms of all-around, well-rounded running back, maybe Mo Ibrahim, his a hair ahead of him.
Yeah, if I had to, you stole my point. If I had to guess, again, going back to what was the Gophers' offensive strategy going into the game, and I think it was to have the wide receivers challenge the secondary, specifically the corners. And in doing so, the next thing on your plate as an offensive coordinator is pass protection. So if that's your game plan, you have to build a game plan around. You have to build subsequent things around that to ensure success. And so if that's what they, you know, went in on a Tuesday or a Wednesday meetings before practice and said, this is what we're going to build, we got to put the pieces underneath it to be successful. The next thing is, okay, we're going to drop back and throw it a few dozen times and challenge the secondary. We got to have the pass blocking set up for that. And so my guess is that that factored into the decision at running back, is to go with a better pass blocker.
Now, on the day, Minnesota actually ran the ball well.
Yeah.
The running backs did anyway. Mm-hmm. They averaged 5 yards a carry on 18 carries. The issue is, and one of the reasons we didn't bring up the running backs or essentially the running game at all to this point, is it's a moot point, because if Minnesota is going to be down double digits again, which they're going to be against Ohio State, you can't run the ball because you're running the clock and it's just a quicker way to lose. Now, Minnesota ran the ball effectively against Iowa, which how much of that is Iowa just dropping 7 into coverage because they were up double digits and knew they didn't have to stop the run. It wasn't like Minnesota was up 10 and they had to dedicate a lot of people to stopping the run, so Minnesota couldn't just run the clock. But for the short term for Minnesota right now, when the reality is they're going to have to be passing the ball a lot, especially this upcoming weekend against Ohio State. Mo Ibrahim makes sense. He's the better pass blocker. I was very impressed, by the way. He wasn't afraid to stick his nose and meet an oncoming blitzer and then stonewall them. You talk about trying to keep Zach Anixet upright. Minnesota struggled with that. Well, it wasn't because of the running back missing on pass pro. It was because Mo Ibrahim wasn't afraid to put himself out there. So I think some folks are marking this day down on the calendar where I say nice things about Mo Ibrahim. I mean, the kid wasn't afraid. He was physical, exactly the way you want to play it against a rivalry team like Iowa. So in terms of the split, I don't think talking about the running game makes a whole lot of sense, just because it's about 9th, 10th, or 11th on the list of things that needed to be addressed if Minnesota is going to start winning ball games again.
All right, let's talk a little special teams. It would be foolish of us to not at least address it, because it did play a factor in this game, at least from my vantage point. I think Mr. Burns, you probably have a little redemption in the flack you've been getting on Jacob Herbers. He struggled. From my perception, he struggled mightily in this game. Wasn't able to flip the field on multiple occasions where he had opportunities. So I'll let you have your moment in the sun.
I'd rather not, just because if my argument, or I guess my stance, is winning, that means Minnesota's not. Because the two things I think that we need to talk about, gentlemen, about special teams is, number one, Jacob Herber struggles again. It's the whole Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing, where first 11 punts for Jacob Herber's 39 average, 2+ over 50, one inside the 20. Next 11 punts are 44 average, 8 inside the 20, and like 7 inside the 15. Well, Jacob Herber's on the day against Iowa, 4 punts for a 37 average, none over 50, and 1 inside the 20. If you're going to have a 37 average, all 4 of those better be inside the 20. Only one of them was. You talk about trying to flip field position. That's not going to help you win games when your punter's only got 1 inside the 20 and the 37 average. The other thing that I'm curious for both your opinions on, that is way down on my list of things to be addressed, but I know this really upset some people, was Minnesota calling fair catch on the kickoffs. Now, I can tell you that the kickoff guys or kickoff return guys were told, fair catch it, we're going to take the guaranteed at the 25. And, you know, our offense doesn't need to start at the 17 or the 18 or the 20. We want to take the guaranteed 25. You two basically, they're essentially saying without saying, you guys aren't as dynamic as Rodney Smith, Shannon Brooks, or Antoine Winfield in return game, and we're just going to take the sure thing at the 25. So, Eric, what were your thoughts on the punting on the day, and what were your opinions on Minnesota deciding a fair catch?
Well, it's sounding a bit like a broken record, but I have to believe that the coaching staff looked at Iowa's kick coverage throughout the year, balanced that against what they were seeing in practice from their kick return, and didn't see a favorable outcome there and made that decision. The only thing I could add is, and Luke probably knows this, one of the strategies used to be on kick coverage is to kick high, shorter kicks and try to pin the returners, but, you know, inside the 20. So it's glass half full, half empty. I understand the frustration as a fan. You're looking for an explosive gain. You're looking for something. And kick returns are fun in a game where you're needing to come back. It's easy to envision in your mind a kick return for a touchdown, a quick 7 points. But the glass half empty is, if you have a team that makes it a strategy to kick the ball directionally and try to get the ball inside the 5-yard line, but not necessarily kicking for a touchback, you're actually wanting, you know, that offense to take the return team to take the kick, try and return it, and now you've tackled them at the 15-yard line. So if that was part of their strategy, then, you know, you're actually looking at it and say, no, we'll take the ball at the 25. We'll eliminate any chance of getting pinned deep.
Yeah, I'll add this, and especially on kickoffs, I think this is an area the Gophers struggled mightily in kick coverage. One was, you know, Emmett Carpenter seems to be good for one kick out of bounds just about every game. And part of that is they are trying to directionally kick a decent amount of the time. So where, you know, like to Derek's point, they're trying to keep it short and try and pin them inside the 25. The problem was, you know, he kicked one out of bounds. And number two was that they didn't do a very good job of covering. Smith Marset had, what, 2 returns for an average of 44 and a half yards with a long of 49. That's not very good. And at a certain point, you know, defensively, you almost want to say, well, let's just kick it through the back of the end zone, take our chances at the 25. Because they quite frankly, have to be better in kick coverage, because they didn't do themselves any favors in kick coverage on the 2 returns.
No. I think that's about as simple as I can put it. Between Iowa's kick coverage team, between Minnesota not exactly trusting their returners to be dynamic and give them better field position than the 25. I think you're going to see a lot of fair catching going forward.
Yeah, and I think, and we talked about this in the preview. We thought that, you know, on paper, the Gophers had arguably had a chance to have better special teams. And, you know, if it was a close game, we definitely felt Carpenter was the better kicker. But obviously that never came to fruition. But they didn't show that they had better special teams overall on the day, in my opinion. But kudos to Colton Beebe, 16 yards on his return. I thought he fielded that ball admirably and returned majestically. I'm not saying this like a Linval Joseph type thing, but he did a great job fielding that squib kick. So
I agree. So before we kind of wrap this up, Luke, I do want to get both of your parting thoughts on the fact that where do we go from here? You're not going to beat Ohio State, but you look at the next five games after Ohio State, you're likely going to be traveling to Nebraska to face a winless Husker team. You have Indiana at home on a Friday night. You have to then travel to face the Fighting Lovie Smiths of Illinois, and you have Purdue and Northwestern before Wisconsin. I still think all five of those games I just mentioned, Nebraska, Indiana, Illinois, Northwestern, Purdue, I think all five are winnable. Three of the five are at home. The two away games are arguably against the two worst teams there, at Nebraska, who's likely going to be winless, at Illinois, who's likely going to have just the one Big Ten win over Rutgers. Where does this team get back on track? Because it's going to be a three-game losing streak going into Nebraska. How does the defense get out of this rut that they're in? I don't know how to fix the defense right now, and that's my biggest concern. Is Eric, when you look at this defense against Maryland, they get gouged on the ground. Against Iowa, they get gouged through the air. You're likely going to get gouged against both on Saturday at Ohio State with the caliber of athletes that they have compared to Minnesota right now. How does this team get back on track defensively?
Yeah, I think they need to sit down and determine what it is, what they want their identity to be on defense, what they want to be, what they want their focus to be. Yeah, sorry.
That is literally the thing that I wrote about. Is I knew what Tracy Clay's and Jay Sobel's defense wanted to be. I don't know what Rob Smith's defense wants to be right now, and maybe that's the overlooming theme of this episode, is what does this defense want to be? Because we haven't seen it be consistent through two games there.
Through 2 years, really.
Through 16, 17 games, maybe. And again, I'm sure Fleck and Smith will say, well, we don't have the personnel. Well, the personnel you have has been successful in running what they're good at. Blake Cashman, Thomas Barber, Carter Coughlin, Jacob Huff to an extent. These guys have made big-time plays in Big Ten games and been successful. But these guys are, and specifically Barber and Cashman, they're the ones looking lost right now. And that mystifies me, because Thomas Barber was one of the best coverage linebackers in the Big Ten last year. He got burned on a double move for a touchdown. Why are these guys playing slow? Why are they not playing at full speed? To me, that means that they're not understanding whatever the coaching staff is trying to teach them. And that's concerning to me.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they could, if I could, you know, suggest one thing is, it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but I think they could perhaps dial up the aggressiveness a little bit with some of their calls on defense. You would think that would get them in more trouble, but sometimes when you're not putting guys in more of a read and react position, trying to spend as much time diagnosing the offensive play, Blake Cashman is a perfect example of, he's the type of player that is at his best when he has an assignment pre-snap, and that's not going to change. So if he knows he's going to be blitzing, or he's going to be running an exchange with one of the defensive linemen, he can run full speed, attack the play, go after the ball carrier. That's where he's at his best. He's not as good when he has to sit back and diagnose the play. And if it's run, he's got to figure out if it's zone or if it's power. He's got to fit his gap. And I think we see some of that going on in the secondary as well. So I know the coaching staff has been hesitant to do that, especially in coverage, to do more heavy blitzing, to run more tight coverage. But maybe they need a little bit of that. I mean, maybe that's going to help these guys dial it in a little bit and be a little bit more aggressive, take some of the thinking out of the game, and let them, you know, go out and focus on effort and know their assignment pre-snap and get after it a little bit.
You know, I find it a little bit ironic that as we're talking through, you know, we're in basically, you know, halfway through year two of PJ Fleck. We've almost done a complete 180 in terms of what our concerns are for the programs in general, right? So, you know, Kill Clay's, you know, we knew what we had on defense. It was very aggressive. They took a lot of risk, but there was a decent amount of reward with that. We saw that in terms of what they were able to do, you know, in lots of games, and they leaned on their defense. Now we're sitting here, we're almost begging the defense to be more aggressive, because at this point they haven't been. In the offense, where we begged and begged for them to just take a shot, they're doing that now, right? They're being more aggressive on offense. They're taking risks. But I'll say this. At the end of the day, year in, year two, if you don't win a bowl game, I think, or not win a bowl game, if you don't make a bowl game, given this schedule, I think that it's more or less a, not a lost season, but it's definitely a failure.
Well, you look at the next four Big Ten games. Again, Ohio State, you're not going to beat Ohio State. Not with the state of this defense.
But if right they now. Do, wouldn't that be awesome?
Well, wouldn't that be a turnaround?
I know.
Wouldn't that be a turnaround? You are at Nebraska, home against Indiana, at Illinois. A winless Nebraska team, an Indiana team that I think you get them at home on a Friday night. I still think that's a 50-50 game that Minnesota can win. At Illinois, I think you still beat Illinois. And then you have home games against Purdue and Northwestern. Yeah, these are winnable games. The question is going to be, and you stated it, Luke, if you're looking at this Gopher offense right now and you're not feeling optimistic long term, I don't know what you're looking at, but defensively, Minnesota starters right now, 10 of 11 are upperclassmen. So what is the identity of this defense especially going to look like next year or in 2020 when this offense is really going to be humming, when there's going to be all brand new players outside of Terrell Smith? You know, you want these guys to be able to grow and develop. These are guys, especially on like the defensive line. You look at the defensive line. We talked about Carter Coughlin and how he's been succeeding in the pass rush. The other seven guys, some of them are Clay's guys, some of them are Fleck guys, and they're just not getting it done. And that's where I'm coming back to. This defense needs to start to show some things that, number one, they have an identity and they're going to stick to it. And number two, that they're showing development from these guys who we've seen play at a high level, and they're not playing at a high level. How do they fix it? And it's not going to get any easier this weekend. There's a lot of things that have to be shored up before Minnesota has, you know, that October 20th game at 2:30 p.m. against Nebraska, which, as we sit here today, I still think they should win.
Yeah. Boy, it's going to be an interesting season. It's obviously been a little bit of a roller coaster. You know, it was high, and then now it's kind of gone this downward trajectory. Let's hope that they can turn it around. We want to thank everyone for listening. Again, if you enjoy the podcast, rate and subscribe. We appreciate that. And again, want to thank our sponsor, the Goal Line Club. Once again, thanks, folks. Go Gophers.